Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Spencer Don't Smack Me Williams.
I knew it was going to be in relation to the Oscars.
Oh, it's just such, it's literally the only thing anybody's talking about nowadays. So, I mean, hey, you know, but we're not alone. Speaking of smacks, we got the queen of smacks over here. Snacks? Smacks?
What?
Why are you signing?
Because this is a podcast. Because Coda won Best Picture for the Oscars.
And people are going to know that when you talk about a podcast because, by signing it, right?
Yeah, because
also with us today is Amy, who has come along the show to talk with us today. I'm sorry.
Not just in sign language.
We got a great show ahead of us as we are going to be talking about the 100th anniversary of an age-old film that has stood the test of time, Nosferatu. So stick around as we talk about that. But before we do, Spencer, give them opening credits.
Tune in each and every Wednesday morning on all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
That's right. You can check us out on our website where we got everything from anime, romance, action. We got everything now. We're like Blockbuster, but in the new age.
Yeah, and not dumb enough to not buy Netflix.
Exactly. check us out, filmlosophers.com. Also on our social pages at filmlosophers. Facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101. Also, you can listen to us anywhere where there are podcasts streaming. We're on iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn. You can tune in to us anywhere you find podcasts. Give us a subscribe. Give us a 5-star review. I think we deserve it, right?
Yes. Yes, we do.
You hesitated.
I was looking for it in the notes. Sorry. I can only do one thing at a time.
Amy, what are we going to do? I don't even know.
Look forward in the notes. And get 5-star reviews.
Yes.
And give 5-star reviews. So we're excited to dabble in a little bit of mischief as we talk about Nosferatu. But before we do, I want to see if Jane Unseen has anything that she's unseen today.
Well, not this. I actually saw this. This will be my second viewing of what we're doing today. But I did see this week 1987's Predator.
About dang time.
Yes. It happens, okay?
Oh, my
there
God.
There are things.
I know where the meme comes from.
Getting to the choppa? Or you son of a bleep. We don't have a sheep. But, which was great for the Crusaders, shout out, because that was used as a... like a way to say thank you for people subscribing to the channel for a long time, so I never knew what it was. But yes, I did see 1987's Predator, starring, of course, one Arnold Schwarzenegger, and then for me, a personal favorite, weirdly, Carl Weathers.
Yes. I thought you were going to say Jesse Ventura.
No,
I knew it was Carl Weathers.
It's Carl Weathers.
The man's gone, like, conspiracy theorist now and governor of some state that's crazy enough to elect him. But, I mean, hey, you know.
I mean, we elected Arnold.
But he didn't do too bad. And he only had one kid outside of his...
also had that whole goal for fitness. He kept pushing the fitness routine.
I don't know. I wasn't here that long. I was in Texas.
That would explain it.
They were giving kids to junior hires, so I don't know.
They were giving kids to junior hires.
They were giving guns to junior hires, sorry.
Kids
that's actually more confusing.
That's worse.
No, they were teaching kid gun safety in junior high.
Okay, there you
that
go.
That makes more
anyway.
Sense.
Not safe pregnancy, though.
Oh, gosh. All right.
They're talking from the ghetto.
This movie was directed by John McTiernan, because I can't pronounce his name.
McTiernan.
And written by the brothers Jim and John Thompson. It is the first installment of the Predator franchise. And if you're wondering if I've seen any of the other ones, no.
If you just saw this one, I'm pretty sure you have no clue about any of the other goodness
I mean,
other ones.
Predator versus now, Alien? I have
You mean Alien
PvP.
Versus Predator?
Yep, either way.
Oh my God.
I was. So
just to add a little bit of note here, hold on. Because you have. Two main Alien films.
Mm-hmm. Which I've seen.
And then, no, you haven't. You haven't seen Danny Glover. When they're in Chicago.
Oh, you said too many alien movies.
Sorry, too many Predator films.
This is problematic for you, sir.
I don't. You know what? It's whatever you put in this cup here. It's I swear. Geez, she brings geez. This jar of voodoo juice and says, we're here, drink it this. Juice. Doesn't even tell us what it is until
put
we start
it on
drinking.
The record. The juice.
So there's two Predator films right now. There's the one with Arnold, the second one with Danny Glover. And then after that, you have the AVP franchise, which is 1 and 2, Requiem. And then you have The Predators, which is... Or no, The Predator, which is the one with... what's his name? The guy from the... No, the one from...
2018.
No, the one from The Pianist.
Adrian Brody.
Adrian Brody. Where Adrian Brody, Lawrence Fishburne, Michelle Rodriguez, Danny Trejo, they all get dropped on a planet. And instead of the Predator coming to get them, they actually get relocated to another planet. It's like a game reserve. It was interesting. And then you have...
2018.
2018's The Predators or whatever it's called.
The Predator.
Keegan Michael Key and that ridiculous
and
one.
That one was where I was sitting in San Diego Comic-Con in Conan, and I got to be like, I have no idea what's going on, but I'm here having a good time.
That's where I was at Comic-Con, and I was with the director of that movie fighting security at San Diego Comic-Con because we couldn't get in.
It happens to the best of us. It's okay.
All right, so tell us what you thought of the film.
So, I finally understand the memes. I finally understand the jokes. I finally understand when we talked about Bloodsport and Jean-Claude Van Damme in the giant pink outfit. Wow. This was actually surprisingly good. Alan Silvestri, of course, is the main composer for this movie, and I love Alan Silvestri, but I had problems sporadically where it was like, hey, we found a camp, and there's gorillas in it. Not the, like, the animals, but the bad guys.
What?
It was very... There were,
I'm lost.
There
what
was,
is happening?
There were bars that sounded like Back to the Future, like some of the way it was.
Yes,
so it was
does.
A little... It was a little too cheerful to make me scared.
I mean, it's Alan Silvestri. What do
it's
you expect?
Brilliant. He's brilliant.
It's like every Lin-Manuel Miranda song has those same cadences, too. So, I mean...
I know, but Alan Silvestri has
it was
bigger
funny.
Filmography.
She mentioned to me this weekend that she saw the film, and I said, great, because I've always wanted to tell you, when you say things under your breath, you remind me of Billy when he goes, I'm going to have me so fine. I'm going to have...
I thought that was Mac.
It is Mac.
It's Mac, because Billy's the tracker, which I was like, you die first.
No,
don't
because,
you die first.
Because this is why I got it mixed up, because she told me she saw the film, and I'm like, oh, great. And we had that conversation. She goes, now it makes sense for the Toy Story of Terror, which is a short film on Disney Plus. I hadn't really seen it. She goes, oh, but it makes sense now. I'm like, what the heck are you
talking
about?
Combat Carl.
So, because Combat Carl's kid is named Billy. So,
it's Carl Weathers as Combat Carl. And he loses a hand.
And
it's so
Carl
good.
Weathers loses his arm, you know, as he's still shooting and he hits the ground.
So anyway, if you haven't seen this, I appreciated the shit. This was shenanigans, just straight shenanigans. I tried not to critique the military aspects of it based on things because I'm learning to let go.
We, Spencer, need to find a movie that is in the wheelhouse of something that we know well enough that we can be obnoxiously critiquing during the course of it.
Oh, that's like Hackers.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I like Hackers.
The internet is not a city.
Okay, so...
That soundtrack, though.
So you got a chance to see Jane on... you got to see a chance
Predator.
To see Predator. Any last thoughts before we move forward?
I don't know how to say give me the weapon in Spanish, but she was very forceful that young
Dame la arma.
There you go. See, you know how to say give me the weapon, and
I know movies. And I know this line. My family, I don't know if I've mentioned this, my mom loves that line from Predator when she goes, give me the weapon. Like, my mom used to walk around the house and say that to everybody. Like, it would be like I'd have the broom in my hand and she goes, get me the weapon! And I'm like, what is that? What are you doing? She goes, just give me the dang thing. So
yeah, I would recommend this. Preferably, I think it would be fun if you were...
I would recommend this over 30-year-old movie if you haven't seen it.
I hadn't.
It's good.
I hadn't, and I think, this is going to sound ridiculous, if I had gotten crunk before I watched this, it would be even funnier. Because I found it funny. And so then you're I found it alarming.
So you're saying that you finally saw the movie that everybody's been telling you to see, and now you're telling everybody else who has probably already seen it that they should see it. Is that what I'm getting?
Yeah.
Okay, just making sure.
And if they're listening to me now, I have some credibility, but I don't think I do.
Very little.
Yay, very little.
Well, like I said, if you want to check out more of Jane Unseen, we'll be cutting up excerpts and sending it over for her Instagram page, which she'll give you the handle at the end of the show. But before we do that, we're going to transition over to our main topic of the night, and that is the celebration of 100 years in cinema history for the longevity of this German film, and that is 1922's Nosferatu. So this movie has been around since 1922. You're looking at me and it's 100 years.
I know.
Take 100 years back from today.
No, it's just the concept of how long the runtime for this movie, but also how long it has been able to sustain itself and been able to continually be restored, where you can watch it and it's not super crackly.
So the film's been through a lot of ups and downs, and we'll talk about that in a second. But before we do, Spencer, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness?
Thomas Hutter is tasked by his employer to visit the mysterious Count Orlok at his castle about a prominent property purchase. The eerie Orlok seeks to buy a house in Hutter's town of Wisborg. Hutter bid his wife Ellen farewell and makes way to the castle as a series of strange events occur. After meeting the strange Count Orlok, Hutter discovers to his horror that the Count is a vampire and seeks to use Wisborg as his new hunting grounds.
That's right. Directed by F.W. Murnau, the film stars Max Schreck as Count Orlok, Greta Schroeder, and Gustav von Wangenheim. Turning 100 years old on March 4th of 2022, Nosferatu is actually a favorite among many notable figures in Hollywood. Among them, Werner Herzog, Guillermo del Toro, Roger Ebert, and many more. In fact, I don't know if you guys know this, but the Vatican put this in the top in the art category of like top 100 films or something.
The Vatican?
The Vatican did.
All the popes are like, "Hey, you seen this film? You seen this film?"
Another little key point, all known prints and negatives were actually destroyed under the terms of settlement of a lawsuit by Bram Stoker's widow. However, the film was subsequently surfaced through second generation reels in other countries. So I don't know if you guys know this, but during the time when this film was being created, obviously F.W. Murnau, he knew he was going to get sued. So he made it, he put as much money into it and everything. Essentially, the funny thing is that the movie itself, the widow of Bram Stoker wanted to actually get what is it called when you get
compensation?
They wanted to get compensated, but they couldn't because the studio used all its money in promotion of the film. So, but as like I said, as a result of the terms, every single film in Europe was destroyed. Right before they made the settlement to destroy all the European versions of the film, they had already sent off a couple of reels to the U.S. for distribution. So there were some in the United States that were whole. However, they were under the Dracula name. And because of the legal ramifications and so forth, they couldn't necessarily show it in a lot of different theaters. It wasn't until in the 1960s when Dracula became public domain, and they were able to now then screen the film in the ways that they could here in the U.S. So a little bit of interest in terms of the journey that this film has gone through. One last piece of information. The concept in popular culture that sunlight is lethal to vampires is based on this film, which depicted such a death for the very first time in film history. So technically the very first death for a vampire in cinema history happened in 1922. So, you know, mark your calendars, folks. F.W. Murnau knew that he would be sued for borrowing heavily from Bram Stoker's 1987 novel Dracula without permission, so he changed the ending in order so that he could say that this film and Dracula were not exactly the same. However, even if you're blind, you could tell that there was a lot of similarities. So this movie right here is essentially a monument, if you will, in the history of cinema. As this movie, if you look at any movie in terms of having the most amount of impact in cinema as well as the most amount of controversy to it as well. There are very few films you can actually say hold that kind of award. I mean, obviously, if you look at movies like Birth of a Nation, that movie's been around for a while, but doesn't have the positive impacts that we all know and love. Movies that have really kind of expanded upon, you know, certain ideologies and things like that, they're okay. But then you look at Nosferatu, and you look at the impact it's had, not only just in horror and the horror genre, but in cinema altogether. And there are so many things that it's done for movies. Right off the bat, I know I'm drawn from a very shallow well here, but when it comes to vampire films, don't give me that look, Amy. I know you've probably maybe seen one vampire film, and it was probably a DCOM. So don't even look at me.
Well, there is a DCOM.
See, I told you.
There's my mom's dating a vampire with.
What did I say?
I've seen more than one.
Okay, so then let's start with you.
Yeah.
So I want to know, what is the knowledge of your history with vampire films? Because I know you just recently saw Bram Stoker's Dracula with Gary Oldman.
Yeah, it was sick, but it was great.
So give me the depth of your knowledge here. I'm not trying to...
Do you want me to start on the cringe level or the non-cringe level?
You have a cringe level of vampires?
Oh, it's called Twilight, homie.
Oof.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the DCOM.
I mean, if you want to go that...
Little Monsters, Little Vampire, Interview with a Vampire, Queen of the Damned, Blade, didn't see Blade 2.
For somebody who hasn't seen a lot of movies, you happen to say you've seen all these movies.
I have. Because I have. So it happens like that when you do that. I can't remember if Little Monsters counts kind of as a vampire movie because it kind of doesn't.
I don't think so because they have a sunlight thing, but like
that's talking about the one with Howie Mandel
and that's
not a vampire movie.
Yeah,
even though that one character really feels like
right and Lost Boys.
But there is a movie called Little Monsters or Little Vampire.
Yeah. They made a couple versions of that.
Kid from Jerry Maguire, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
And then there's also an animated version of that. Don't do it.
Okay. So
I have some.
You have some. That's good.
I have a chunk.
A
fair swathing of them.
Good. So where does your allure with that particular genre fall in? Are you more of like, because what you just stated is it's a good swath. It's a great swath. But it also includes a very wide spectrum from the very much Victorian-style, Transylvanian, old-world type of Dracula, all the way to, like, a new world, modern day, even in, like, a neo-noir-style type vampire. Mm-hmm. Where do you find yourself liking more so?
To be very honest, traditionally there was a book series that's not a very good book series. Oh, there was True Blood too, but those are all television shows.
Yeah, we're talking about movies here.
So there was a book series called...
Focus.
Well, there was an Anita Blake book series that actually had one of the main protagonists who was a 1,000-year-old vampire, and he was Louisiana, so I kind of sway more...
I'm sorry, he was what?
He was from Louisiana.
Okay.
Louisiana. Sorry, not Louisiana. Louisiana. There you go. You're welcome.
So he was Cajun or Southern.
So I fall kind of in that Anne Rice Interview with a Vampire space.
Okay.
I enjoy more of that tone versus like Blade made modern vampires, and so did Queen of the Damned, like cool. Like that was the intrinsic value of it. Oh, and there's one that was Tom Hiddleston and what is her name? Uma Thurman. Not Uma Thurman. Darn it. I'm going to remember that one later. That was a really good one. Anyway, so I focus more on the semi-traditional than I do the modern vampires. Does that make sense?
I mean, you said a lot. I don't know if it actually amounted to anything, but you did say a lot.
Give me creepy people slightly in the dark, oldie-ish times. And they're vampires makes more sense to me.
So you're talking about the one with Tom Hiddleston, Tilda Swinton, and Mia Wasikowska.
Yes.
Only Lovers Left Alive.
Yes.
That
one's crazy.
It's a very unique journey. What about you, Spencer? Maybe you can give us a little bit more of a understandable answer.
DCOM.
Where does your swath of Dracula lore, you know, fall in?
Actually, it comes from TV shows, which makes okay, a well, very short list.
There we go. Okay. I'm hearing Buffy at the very top. Here we go. Buffy.
No, I didn't see that movie. I only see the TV show.
No, that's what I mean. The TV show.
TV show.
Yeah, Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yeah. So for movies, it really comes only down to two of them. It is. I literally just started drawing a blank. Did I just look it up? Darn it. Oh, The Lost Boys. Because you mentioned that, and I saw that. That was great.
Yeah.
And then I did see. Once while I was in Comcast waiting for them to do something, like the back half of one of the Twilight movies, it was like a birthing scene, and I was
that's
this
very into the trilogy,
like unacceptable in a public setting. And so that's all of my movie.
we need to get you the picture of the baby that they birthed. Because it's scary.
I don't need that in my life, thanks.
To the Google.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so your experiences with TV more than film.
Yeah, like Buffy and Angel and the nonsense that happened in that universe.
So my kind of, well, if you will, kind of goes back pretty far. Like, I'm currently wearing, like, a Universal Monsters shirt of Frankenstein. I couldn't find my Dracula one. Go figure. But I have a Dracula one. It's just not the one I'm wearing right now. Looking at my shirt. But I go, my history goes back to like the Universal Monsters to Nosferatu. I remember the first time I saw Nosferatu on PBS. Oh. It was a Saturday evening movie, and they were talking about the restoration of it and this and that. And I was just like, you know, I want to see this movie. This looks like a really interesting movie. So I saw it late at night and pretty much became afraid of Count Orlok at the age of like 7 or 8.
It doesn't matter how old you are, that man is brilliant and scary.
Mm-hmm. Max Shrek. Yeah. Shrike. It's one of those. It's German.
It's
that's all we know.
German.
But after seeing it, I was like, I just kind of became hooked on the classic ability of bringing horror. And then it just came with, like, the Universal movies. But then I learned there was more than just the Universal movies at that time. You had, like, the Hammer films with Sir Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing, Sir Christopher Lee playing both Dracula at some time and Van Helsing at some times.
He's scary.
And it's great seeing those ones. And then I don't really remember about any films during the 70s, but I know as soon as the 80s hit, it was like Fright Night. It was like,
I forgot a question
about Fright Night.
Yeah.
Blackula?
No.
Why? So that's a...
Because I thought it was a B-movie.
I'm sorry. That was kind of a pointed question.
I thought it was a B-movie. Like, am I incorrect?
For everybody who doesn't know, Spencer's black. So,
well, yeah, that's like,
that's a podcast before.
Like Spencer?
Well, I was
signing. Do you know Aunt Jemima? That's kind of how that question came across. No, it's.
I don't know how to classify that movie.
I mean, it's just based on the name alone, I would assume so as well.
No, it's
and
it's
you
so
love B-movies.
Blackula. No. Blackula came at the height of horror blaxploitation films. Mm-hmm. So Blackula actually holds a very special place in cinema. I haven't seen all of them because there's several of them. I've seen the first one, but Blackula is a very, very important film in the history of blaxploitation.
Okay,
so
that's going on the list for
the poignant question
it.
Of looking
I
at Spencer
know.
And saying, "Excuse me, sir."
Well, he also mentioned that
might
he'd
you
seen
be a rapper today?
Oh no, we are not going back to last week's episode of Jaden Boots Riley. But
I'm sorry.
But he did mention he'd seen Fright Night, right, Spencer? That's what you
yes.
like. Yeah, so there he's got another one.
I mean, you got things like Fright Night. You got things like, what's that movie? Salem's Lot with the Stephen King movie. You got a ton of movies that really embody a lot of that. And it didn't start happening until the latter part of the 90s and early 2000s that the push for action-packed vampire movies really came about. Because then you started getting movies like Queen of the Damned. You started getting movies like Priest. Like Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
That was 2000s, though.
That's what I said, late 90s and then 2000s.
Well, I'm assuming you also were going to bring in Let the Right One In, right? Isn't that a vampire
film? Let Me In, the original, and then Let the Right One In, which is the remake. I could be wrong. Yeah, Let Me In is the original, and
There's a lot of letting people in.
Let the Right One In is the original. Let Me In is the American remake.
Look at that.
Which is a great movie. I love that movie. If you actually are more interested in the story element of somebody who is a vampire. By the way, also in that frame, Ginger Snaps is also a horror movie that's about vampires, but also subtly on the side of, you know, hitting puberty as a girl and learning.
You're bringing it back to that turning red moment where you still can't find a positive.
I'm a big red monster. Godzilla.
Hey.
even movies like From Dusk Till Dawn with Robert Rodriguez, and then where the beautiful elements of this story kind of gets to be explored in Guillermo del Toro's Kronos. You get opportunities like that. And like I said, the late 90s and whatnot. Oh, obviously, The Lost Boys. You said a really great one. But, you know, 30 Days a Night is another one. Dracula 2000. Rise was a great one. I don't know if you've ever seen the anime. It's actually based on an anime with Lucy Liu. She's not in the anime, but she plays in the live-action version. So, and the great thing is that the exploration of this idea for vampires has really kind of evolved, because we even had, within the last 5 years, we had a Middle Eastern take on the vampire story with A Girl Walks Alone, Walks Home Alone at Night.
I saw the trailer for that.
Which is a phenomenal movie and really does explore more of the presence of being a vampire in that type of world and environment. So there's a lot. Thankfully, I've stayed away from ridiculous ones that I'm not too keen on, like The Little Vampire. I never seen that one. Movies like the Blood Rain movies by Uwe Boll.
Oh, God.
isn't everybody at this table blocked by that man on Twitter? I am.
I'm blocked, but I haven't really looked at it.
Spencer's like, I could check and get blocked real quick.
but here's the thing. Vampire movies have all evolved over the course of time. And if we look at cinematic history, the very first one to take not a direct interpretation, but an artistic interpretation was the film that we're talking about today, which is, Nosferatu, Murnau's take on that. Now, I know that it's a very unique thing to take inspiration from and then hope to God that you don't
get in trouble.
Yeah, you don't get in trouble. But back in the day, like, who would have thought? I honestly, back in like 1922, I didn't think like people were so like up to date on what's going on in the legal system, be like, oh my God, that's a copyrighted whatever, blah 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 blah, and go after them for money.
You never know, like, some people could have been after that story for other reasons, and she's like, I know what my rights are.
I know my rights.
Well, you have to think about how much notoriety Nosferatu actually got the film for her to even find out about it, one, yeah. And then two, be able to go, oh my gosh, it's you owe me money.
True, because she came at him with a force. Like I mentioned earlier, the lawsuit literally spelled out that he had to destroy all the copies of the film reels. He had to pretty much produce every amount of information that he had that was towards the film and give it up. And then she was trying to get compensation, and that obviously wasn't going to happen. Nope. Sadly, Murnau actually passed away in 1931, so he never actually got a chance to see his movie get the widespread attention that it has now, the worldwide spread attention that it's got now. But he passed away in 1931, and then, like I said, when Dracula became public domain in the 60s, that's when everybody started viewing Nosferatu and being able to see it in some form of print. So it's really sad to see how this progression of this story and this movie has come about to be what it is today. It's funny. I was talking with Spencer. We were talking a little bit on the couch, and we were like, you know what the dumbest thing that came to mind while we were watching this movie, because we were both on the same page, the fact that looking at this movie, everybody in this movie is dead. Like, literally not alive. We're like, that cat's not here in this world anymore.
The cat is what set it off for me. Because, like, the woman is, like, playing with a cat, and I'm like, that cat's dead. His man is like, everyone in this movie is most likely dead. Like, Like, unless there's a baby in a scene.
But
maybe.
Even then, a baby in 1922?
Yeah.
100-year-old baby?
Yeah. Maybe.
I mean, if she survived World War II and everything else that was
World War One and... No, World War One was right before that. Yeah. It was on the tail end of it.
It was on the tail end of World War One. World War Two.
World War Two, the Vietnam War, the Korean War, you know.
The wall.
That baby could have dodged a lot of wars.
Oh, yeah.
For all we know.
Germany. Berlin Wall. Yeah, it's true.
A lot of wars.
Mr. Gorbachev. Bring down the wall.
Tear down that wall. Okay.
But... Here's the
everyone's
thing.
Everyone's dead. That's what you got. Cat, everyone's dead.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's basically what
I mean,
your brain is amazing. I mean, and I do not mean that sarcastically.
If you know Spence, so cool. I mean, Spence and cats are like oil and water. They just don't mix.
Except the one that tries to follow him into the studio all the time.
That's ridiculous.
Or our friend's cat that you actually don't mind. What was his name? The orange cat?
Orange cat.
The one that belonged to Crystal and Corey?
There's a big
oh, yes. I
what was his name?
Was it like Whitaker?
Whitaker.
Yeah. That's a good name, though.
They were a very good name. Yeah.
And you actually got along with that cat.
Yeah, there's like a small line of chill cats
it's
where
like,
I'm like, okay.
It's like the ones that are in that small vein.
Yeah, like I wish I could hang out with you more, but I can't. Yeah,
sadly. You'll kill me.
Yeah.
So jumping into the film, because I don't want to spend a lot of time talking, like, reviewing the film, but I really want to kind of explore more of, like, where this film impacts in, like, cinema. Because looking at this movie, yeah, there's a lot of things that it does. Even as an artistic piece, one of the biggest things that Murnau did with this film was create an opportunity to showcase German Expressionism. However, he was also not showing German Expressionism because... If you know what German Expressionism is, it's usually the forced appearance of expanded lines and large rooms and over-exaggerated pieces.
I.e. Tim Burton-esque.
Yes. Actually, Tim Burton's a great example of German Expressionism, but more in his kind of vein.
His variation also somewhat, I would think, some Dr. Seuss, more of his paintings or his portraits when he goes to buildings, kind of matches
it's
that.
It's more in the Expressionism style, because the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which came out right before this movie, is oozing with German Expressionism. Now, one of the things that does differentiate this film from the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari is that the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari was filmed on a set, whereas this movie makes as many attempts to be outdoors as possible, mm-hmm. which is part of the reason why I say it does showcase a little bit of German Expressionism, but it also doesn't. In that aspect. And honestly, what Murnau did with this film is revolutionary. Nobody was doing the stuff that he was doing in this movie, whether if it was the negative tone, whether if he was creating, you know, the overlay of like the scene when on the ship where the sailor sees Count Orlok on the caskets.
Yeah, I was wondering about that scene because I was like, that had to be like a newish technique.
1922.
Yeah.
Like, that was groundbreaking. And people were still trying to figure out how to do that after the fact.
And it was in Pepper's Ghost.
You know, it was, I'm pretty sure that's probably how they probably did it. I don't know.
Pepper.
Well, I didn't look up how that effect worked, but.
I don't know when Pepper's Ghost.
Why don't you explain what the Pepper's Ghost is?
So Pepper's Ghost is most easily recognizable today for anybody that's gone to Disneyland and has been to the Haunted Mansion. You ride through and there's the ballroom sequence and you see all the ghosts that are spinning around the ballroom. The concept of Pepper's Ghost is that you take mannequins or whatever is going to be projected to look ghostly, and it's actually bounced through a mirror as well as a couple panes of glass, mm-hmm. and when it's projected with light into the space, you see a ghostly apparition.
Yeah.
It is a older technique, but I do not remember when it first came around for magicians, but... It's really neat. It's still used today, and it was either that or if they were doing a lay, like an overlay of two films for negatives to get that shot. I don't know, but it was just like, oh, he's there.
Yeah, and it's a great effect because, like you were saying, back in 1922, film was still something that was becoming a mainstay. Like, they were still utilizing it in larger formats. They were trying to use it in larger formats. I mean, you had like little short films, you had other things. But to go above and beyond and create the opportunity where you have something such as, you know, doing effects like that, or creating like the different, you know, unique aspects of filmmaking on what did you call the type of film?
What?
the film that they used.
I don't think I said anything.
Nobody said the type of film.
No, like you remember actual... we were...
Oh, earlier.
Yes.
Sorry.
We're all like, what?
I was like, what? Doing the podcast. No, I said, I just thought it was like some sort of nitrate thing.
Yeah, well, so it's let's see, because I'm pretty sure we'll probably find it.
One of these days we'll find it.
Yeah, it was nitrate film. One of the things about the film is that they wanted to keep a lot of it in, you know, in its original condition, but it was all nitrate. Nitrate. Sorry, I'm losing my mind. Do you know what nitrate film is, Ames?
Is it silver?
No.
I don't then. I could say I do, but for this case, I'm going to say no because I got distracted by, apparently there was a 2000s movie that stars John Malkovich and Willem Dafoe.
And Willem Dafoe.
On the making
Shadow of the Vampire. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good movie.
I got distracted. Yeah.
It's essentially utilizing the conspiracy that Max Schreck, the man who played Count Orlok, was actually a real vampire. mind you, is an American conspiracy.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Everybody in Europe was like, you Americans are stupid. So
I don't know what that accent was. But tell me about the silver nitrate?
No, it's just nitrate. So it's nitrate film. Back in the day, during the 30s and 40s, it was illegal to take a roll or a reel of nitrate film on a trolley car. Because nitrate is extremely flammable.
How flammable is it?
It's so flammable, it could actually ignite just with the sunlight.
Oh, with
the heat of the
it's
sun.
A vampire film.
Because nitrate is essentially, you know, it's explosive in its original raw form. When utilized as film, it was very, very, it was very sensitive. So what they did was they worked in very close guarded areas, but you were never allowed to take, like, you couldn't take a roll of that film into like closed buildings. You couldn't do all that kind of stuff because it was so volatile. Nowadays,
how do people view this film?
Well, so the thing is, that's why they were always so very careful with the film canisters and so forth, which I was telling Spencer, I feel like really lends itself to the ability of why a lot of classic films are still around today, or the original prints, because if you didn't take care of it, it was going to kill you, you know? Yeah. But so when the destroyed copies were found by certain people who were able to put it together and whatnot, I'm pretty sure the names are out there. It was at the beginning of of the film on Amazon. But the individuals who put it together, they had to be very careful because Murnau's original intent was to have it on this type of film because of the sheen that this film gave. And it added to the clarity of the movie itself. Nowadays, we use celluloid, and celluloid is pretty much amongst the same things we use for like your film cameras and things like that. But yeah, I would love to really see kind of like the big difference between celluloid and nitrate. But I don't think it's legal to own or even have nitrate film nowadays. But I wanted to ask you guys, in terms of this particular film, like, where do you guys see the real hero for this story? Because there's a lot of elements in the story between, you know, Hutter, Ellen, you even have the brother-in-law and the sister.
Sister Ruth. Whatever.
And even Count Orlok. Like, where do you guys find yourselves gravitating most of your attention to in this film?
Well, Count Orlok, just every time he's on screen, mm-hmm. he kind of just draws you in with just his bizarre look and just his movements. So, like, every time he was on the screen, I was, like, just kind of, like, glued to it.
Yeah.
As for actual, like, heroes, I guess the main hero of this is Hutter, and then the secondary hero is Ellen.
What do you think about that, Ames?
I mean, based on the story, I fully agree. It's whoever's in the scene actually that catches your attention, because across the board, while watching this, the story itself, Hutter and technically Ellen is supposed to be, well, even though it's an Eileen on some of my
friends. Yeah, that's why I'm like, I feel like I was going crazy. I was like, wasn't it Eileen?
It looked like Eileen. And then it's like Ellen. I'm like, Eileen?
Which, I don't know if you caught in the opening synopsis, Hutter's first name is Thomas.
Mm-hmm. I didn't guess that.
Yeah, it's not said in the film.
Yeah, it says it on the little, the printy scroll bit.
Yeah.
But so it's supposed to be her for story-wise. But with this film, every person that's given screen time and I don't know if it's just the restoration, but they each drew in different aspects of connection and the expressions and the way and movement. Orlok, when he's riding up as the horseman to pick up Hutter to take him up the rest of the way, it's the eyes, it's the hand, it's like, it's jarring. And then when you get to, what was his name? I almost said Choke, and I don't think that's his name.
Knock. You're talking about the
guy real who estate had, guy who had nuts? The glued on eyebrows for cotton. Like, even him. Everything. It was so well done across the board that each character has space and they don't feel lost in the story itself. Like, it's great.
You want to hear what's crazy? So out of that whole film,
you picked the cat.
Count Orlok only has 9 minutes of screen time.
He still leaves that impression that he's constantly foreboding in the background.
Yeah. That's crazy because it feels like he's in it like a lot
more. I feel like his presence is just so like commanding when he's just there that it makes it feel like it lasts for an eternity while he's on screen. Like the unease of his eyes and the way his fingers look and the shape of his bulbous head. It's true.
I watched this. So I've seen this movie twice. First time was a different story. This time watching it.
Didn't you fall asleep the first time you saw it?
Yeah. Okay. So quick story. So I was going on a date and the person that I was with, you know, we went to the Crocker. We watched.
Why don't you tell people what the Crocker is?
So the Crocker Art Museum in Sacramento is an art museum and they were doing a film series and Nosferatu was one of them. So we went. It was great. They talked about, there was a little like blurby speech prior talking about German Expressionism, the Cabin of Caligari, and then they were leading in with Nosferatu. So I was watching it and I was going, okay, it's good. And it got really cold. And it kept getting colder in the space. And I didn't have a thick enough sweater. And I fell asleep probably around the end of Act 3 with the coffins. But so...
Which, by the way, for those who don't know, there's 5 acts to this film.
They tell you.
And she knocked out, apparently, you said, in Act 3?
Yeah, end of Act 3. Anyway, so this time, I actually stayed awake until almost right at the end where I started to fall. But I was watching it with my daughter, who said that when Count Orlok was wearing his weird little hat, and he was just like confused little Count Orlok, he was just creepy, like adorable, like, oh, you're a little weirdo creepy, versus like, ah, he's coming for me creepy. That's how she said it. His little hat, like when she first saw him. And I think the other thing that was confusing for her was the use of the negative tone for the blues and the golds to discern daylight to nighttime because it was all shot during the daytime. She had a little bit of a problem with that, but yeah, she was dead set that Count Orlok in a hat is not as scary as Count Orlok without.
Which, by the
way,
I
also had problems with the tone colors of this movie.
The funny thing is that wasn't actually added until they restored it.
Oh, interesting.
Really?
So that additional, you know, tone color, the tone shift to kind of give it a little bit more. Yeah, that was.
Well, that's because like I was able to piece together blue at night, but like purple.
Right? For some of it, you're like, is it dusk?
Is that dusk? Is it?
And some of it, because the light when they shot was so bright and putting that blue hue, you couldn't tell that it was supposed to be night. That was something I struggled with in a few spaces. Like, initially when they showed up at the castle, he goes, it's almost midnight. The servants are asleep. And I'm like, oh, it is midnight?
Yeah, once he said that, I was like, oh, I get it. Because at first I was just like, oh, I guess they got it from different films that had different hue color qualities or whatever.
All of the above. I think one of the best things about this movie is I truly feel that it is the first time where we see, in a horror film, a female lead take control. of the situation. Because if you look at horror nowadays, if there's one thing that always stands out when it comes to a horror movie, you have one of two things. You either have a damsel in distress, or you have a final girl. And that's typically how it's waged. I mean,
and most of the time you have both.
Sometimes. Like, you sometimes a damsel in distress can be the guy, you know, in terms of the, what's the male term for damsel?
I still call him.
I look at you because
I call him a dude in distress, but okay. That's me.
Dude in distress, whatever it may be. You know, the role is still there. But more so for women, in terms of usually when they're trying to push a female lead, they want to shine away from having a weaker female in the roles, and they want to show that she is stronger than most of the guys. You don't think so?
No, I'm just thinking, so after seeing this the first time, by the way, the date went well, he called me, I was okay, that's great.
Wait, did he leave while you were sleeping?
No, he was nice and let me lean on him and sleep, and then I woke up because everyone was clapping, and he kind of looked at me like, you okay? And I was like, yeah, I'm okay. And then, because, of course, he was walking back to the car, he goes, yeah, you snored. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to.
It probably just added to the music in the film, so.
Maybe, I don't know. But so what I was thinking, and after watching it the second time, how much the 90s Bram Stoker's Dracula with Gary Oldman, how it mirrored it. And the thing was, is Winona Ryder plays, essentially, Ellen, the version of Ellen in this one. And she carries so much frailty in her interpretation of the character, that it doesn't feel like she's taking the same type of lead that Ellen in Nosferatu does. And so that's why it's kind of perplexing, because she ends up being, spoiler, Winona Ryder ends up being the linchpin to the end.
Yeah.
But you're just like, huh?
Yep.
What?
But I feel like having that final girl role, having a strong female character in any horror element, I think just adds, to be honest, for me, adds more reason to be invested in it than if it was just a male-driven type of film. Nobody wants to see a horror movie and just be like, I mean, outside of maybe the outliers like Bruce Campbell in the Evil Dead franchise, you know, or I can't really think of anybody else where the male figure kind of stands out more in the horror film than anything else.
Who ends up being the person that's alive at the end of Cabin in the Woods?
Nobody, because they die.
It's because it's the end of the world, but who's sitting on the steps smoking? There's two people.
Yeah, it's the guy and the girl.
Okay, so they each got out.
Yeah. Well, they
got out, but they ain't going very far.
Yeah, they'll be dead soon.
Yeah, and you look at a lot of the movies that are like that, that are female-driven, or at least have some sense of that. I feel like a lot of it hails back, even not so much in just horror, but even like thriller or sci-fi thriller. You know, I'm looking at Sigourney Weaver in Alien. You know, you're looking at Jamie Lee Curtis in just about everything.
She's still there.
You know, there's a lot of elements that you see. Barbara Crampton, who is the queen of B horror films, she's the main female lead in The Reanimator. Great woman. Great actress.
What about Rose McGowan with her chainsaw leg, or her machine gun leg?
Oh, yeah. In the Grindhouse film, the first one, I forget. Planet Terror, sorry. Yeah, I mean, a lot of those, they really add a lot more to the story. It's not, and mind you, really quick, Planet Terror is just confusing at times, because it's like, you got to see it, because it's like, oh, you're a bad, the sheriff's like, oh, you're a bad guy, or this, isn't that, and then they do this whole thing where like, oh, a reel is missing at this point in time. The movie will resume once the next reel shows up, and then it comes back into the film, and the sheriff's like, I didn't know you were all this, isn't that, I'm sorry, sir, and blah, 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 and I'm like, what is happening? What just happened? So,
who knows? I don't know. I just remember seeing a still of her, and I was like, huh, I think that's in something that Eddie probably saw.
Yeah, the running gag is that Rose McGowan said she wanted to be a stand-up comedian, and so she couldn't hack it and went into stripping.
Huh. Spencer and I, I wish somebody was here to see that moment. We're both just like, okay.
It's, I don't know. But there's so much more in terms of, like, even in the Dracula mythos, and the evolution of that. I mean, we've talked about a few of them. We mentioned a few of them. But where do you see, Ames, like, the most amount of impact from this film in some of the vampire movies you've seen?
Definitely, as I stated, the Dracula, Gary Oldman, Keanu Reeves, Winona Ryder. That one I was seeing where it was this, not only the same beats, but some of the same shots, of the same staging. Like, I was like, oh my gosh, this looks like Nosferatu. Other places where I actively remember seeing moments that carried kind of that same, the allure of it. Oh man, because it's not really an Interview with a Vampire. Some of the, you don't get the same feel.
But is there like elements of the film that you see in it?
Bits and pieces, but this carries so much more, like, it's the foreboding terror. It's the it's the terror that sneaks up at you. It's the
terror that flaps in the night.
Yes, you are Darkwing Duck. It's the long hallway and it's dark and you're hoping to get to the end when you're a kid and you don't know if there's somebody behind you. It bears that presence where he's there and he's not there simultaneously. So this is going to sound really funny, but I would almost have the same type of tone and the feeling that I get from Nosferatu in Halloween, like the original Halloween with the shape, which is something to be said for me that I do not like horror. And I'm like, I can feel that same sense of dread and uncertainty in a 1922 movie and in a 1970s movie. And that's something where I can actively say it feels the same.
Yes.
Because other than that, when we start looking at the German impressionism, we talked about
Expressionism.
I'm not an art major, Spencer. We see it in different directors and different artists. I can pinpoint particular people. But when it comes to vampires, a lot of it is shifted from that same type of feeling of dread. It's more grandeur. And yeah, it stands up on its own two legs in such a unique way. And for it to be as old as it is and then be able to go, oh, that feels like this movie. That feels like that movie. It's really unique.
Yeah. What about you, Spencer? In all the vampire lore that you have through TV and film, where do you see a lot of... Because to be honest, I see a lot of what has evolved as far as vampires in The Lost Boys.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you see that as well in certain terms or whatever.
Well, first off, I want to say the only thing that like really stood out to me was like what wasn't taken. And that was the whole like, well, he needs like the dirt from like his grave. And I was like, I've never heard of this. And I feel like there's like a whole backstory to vampire thing. But I was like, apparently they need their dirt. But in Lost Boys, like it has
like what Amy was talking about, like that foreboding, because you never really see them turn into vampires until like towards the last act of the film, but you see remnants of it, and I feel like that foreboding mindset is part of that.
Yeah, like the foreboding feeling to the movie. Yeah, that's definitely in there. There's also the weird magnetism of the vampire is in both movies, which seems to actually be turned up to 11 in this older movie.
Right?
Because, like, he's affecting people who are miles away.
He's got long-range charm, man. He's got long-range mojo.
Yeah, like, that's actually really terrifying of, like, you know, just enjoying an afternoon tea. All of a sudden, the person across from you is now under the thrall of a vampire.
Yeah. People don't even know to go to, don't even have to go to the club anymore and just like sit here on the couch, send the mojo out. Some woman gets on a plane, like, oh, baby. So,
that's actually like something I think they should probably try to bring back for one of them. Mm. Like just like, you know, long distance, like, you know, enthrallment. Like, because that'd be interesting. Because how are you going to like attack something that can like send people at you from like so far away? Also, like the weird mental connection that the thralls had was interesting too, because like people were just like, oh, he's dead. I'm like, how do you know this?
Oh, like, yeah,
what happened?
Yeah, and I feel like honestly, now that we're talking about it, there could be a little bit of that with the dirt in the Lost Boys. Because do you ever see the vampires leave Santa Clarita? Or is it Santa Clarita?
Santa Cruz. They're technically in Santa
Cruz. Well, they're in Santa Cruz, but the name of the... It's the murder capital of the world, but...
Murder capital.
Santa Clarita. Like, they don't leave that little town. Maybe it's like hometown turf kind of thing. I don't know. Just a thought.
Well, always have to take your home dirt with you.
Exactly. Or sand.
Well, and now even kind of thinking about that, when you look at transitions for vampires that... going to bring up True Blood because it's in there. That concept of them even roaming, but carrying at one point in the books, they bring up that the guy's name's Bill.
A vampire named Bill.
Yeah. He was turned into a vampire during the Civil War. Anyway, the actual actor is married to Anna Paquin. So I was like, hey, good for you, buddy. You did something good. Anyway, he carries a bag with dirt from where he was buried.
Oh.
So
in the book?
In the book.
Is it in the show? I've never seen it, so I don't recall
if it's in the show, but what ends up happening is wherever he's traveling, he carries this bag of dirt, but he ends up, when the movie starts, he's moved back to his home plantation, because it was a plantation.
Uh-huh.
For however many generations it's been passed down, and he's like, I've come home, because vampires, essentially, it takes a kind of like X-Men, Mutant X there. They can live and be out in society now because they don't drink people blood. They drink synthetic blood. Anyway, he carries a bag of dirt, but I don't know in Interview with a Vampire if the same rule applies when Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt are roaming around.
I don't know.
Thinking about that dirt. Dirt.
Yeah. It's interesting because, like, you think of the impact, and even with the foreboding, like the idea of, you know, what John Carpenter did with
The Shape.
And you look at what, you know, people had derived from that, like with Friday the 13th and Jason and everything else that came out, even like with Scream, with Ghostface, the whole idea of this foreboding presence that isn't doing much, but it's mere presence within the scene, creates this sense of dread. And I feel like if we're going back to where it all started, I feel like a lot of that was taken from this movie. But also in that perspective of, you know, kind of playing the long game, the pulling apart of support so that way you can get the one thing that you want by itself. Like in this movie, because he has Hutter all the way on the other side where he's at, and then you ultimately have him pile up his coffins, and then he gets into his coffin and puts the lid on telepathically.
So the first time I saw that, and the second time I saw that, the same thing happened. I was like, hey, stop motion.
Yeah.
I was like, get it, and now you're in dirt.
And it was really cool. It was fun to watch, and the fact that you're seeing somebody, the fact that there are people that were in 1922 that were just not prepared for this, and that whole element of playing the long game, kind of, you know, like a cat with playing with its mouse, the element of the predator is smarter than the prey, or at least the predator thinks he's smarter than the prey, because Count Orlok knew exactly when to leave. He knew exactly to lock him in that room. He knew all that. Count Orlok already had planned that. So that is also one of pretty much, I think, the core archetypes, if you will, of, and I say modern day, within the last 30, 40 years of horror cinema, it's one of the core archetype structures for stalkers, or the main antagonists in horror films, you know, because you want to have somebody who's not so much outlandishly like being, you know, bold blah, about, blah. Oh, I'm this, I'm expositioning, and I'm doing these things, blah, 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 blah. You want somebody who is on the quiet end, knowing that he's already 10 steps ahead of you, making you think he's actually behind him. You know, that's the type of villain that you want to have. That's the type of antagonist you want to have.
You mean a Mr. Brooks?
Yeah, I love me some Mr. Brooks. You've seen Mr. Brooks, haven't you?
No.
Oh, my God. So
this is, you've heard about it. Wait, you're going to hear more about it.
So Mr. Brooks was this film done by Kevin Costner. Don't knock it yet.
Remember when he did K-Pax?
That wasn't Kevin Costner.
Who was it?
That's Jeff Bridges.
Jeff Bridges?
And Kevin Spacey.
It was Kevin Spacey.
Oh, that's what I'm thinking of. Kevin Spacey.
So Kevin Costner, i.e. American Robin Hood, he is essentially... So this was a movie done in the last 10 years. He is a businessman, a devoted husband, and a father. But on the back end, he's also a closeted...
Serial killer.
Not even serial killer. He's addicted to killing. It's not something he wants to do. It's something he has to do. It's what he said. And the great thing about the film is that the late, great William Hurt, who played Thaddeus Ross in the Marvel films, he played Kevin Costner's conscience. And he was like the physical embodiment of this conscience. So you could see the conversation happening back and forth. It is absolutely wonderful. And Mr. Brooks, that movie is so smart. The only downside is it has Dane Cook, but we get to see Dane Cook in all different variations. And,
and Danielle Panabaker.
Danielle Panabaker as well. Oh, and Demi Moore. Almost forgot Demi Moore.
Yep. And Laura Bailey, for anybody that's...
And Laura Bailey in a quick role. But yeah, it's a really great movie. There were rumors that they were going to make a sequel, but
they don't even have to. Like this,
true.
This movie, it can be a very one and done type of film, but it carries a continual sense of dread, a continual sense of foreboding. It is the calculation and the seduction simultaneously of the audience into understanding why you need to kill, as well as the allure that it might be there for Kevin Costner's character.
Because it's the great thing about this movie is it is a movie for both people who get intelligent horror and for people who don't get intelligent horror. Because for those people who don't get it, there's so much exposition in this movie with the conversations between Kevin Costner and his consciousness that you're like, oh, I'm following along. Okay. And then for the intelligent people, you're like, oh, but it's actually this, and it's actually going on with this. It's great. It's like freaking, one size fits all kind of horror.
And I just found out it's on YouTube for free, so everyone can go watch it.
There you go. Wrapping this whole thing up, because I do want to kind of wrap this conversation up and so forth, I want to know, where do you guys see... do you guys see people returning to some of these types of stories or actually taking the vampire story in unique directions? Because obviously this is the first iteration of something like the vampire story, the Dracula story, getting almost twisted, but still in a good way. Do you guys feel like this is something that's going to continue, that we're going to continue to see more exploration of it? Or do you think we're going to go back to the basic formula? We're going to go back to more traditional Victorian type, Transylvanian, Dracula, because we did have that one that was out, 5 years ago, Dracula Untold, that didn't do too well, unfortunately. But who's to say that they're not going to try it again? So what do you guys think, Spencer?
I think they're going to do both. Because I think there's always going to be a space for traditional vampires.
Yeah.
Because there's something about, ooh, we have to go to Transylvania for something, blah, blah, blah. there's always going to be a space for
that. Okay, Adam Sandler. Blah, 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 blah.
And Mel Brooks.
True.
And then I think there's always going to be spaces to innovate, because I think that's the one takeaway from Twilight's, is that someone, whether they should or shouldn't, will innovate in the space and bring something new in. And some of it should be left behind, Sparkles, and other things, we can take forward what's good.
Hey, he's not Sparkles anymore. He's Vengeance.
Okay? Sparkly Vengeance.
Amy, what do you think?
Sparkly Vengeance. I agree actually with Spencer in both sides of this. There is always going to be a space for traditional romantic, gothic vampire stories.
Yeah.
Anne Rice has given us that for years, and there's lots of books and stories that can be adapted.
Side note, did you know Anne Rice became a Christian and wrote a Christian horror book?
Not surprised.
It was actually...
Wait, recently?
It was within the last 10 years. The only reason why I know it is because our friend Rachel had brought it out. She brought it to one of our events, and she's like, look what I found. So, sorry, continue.
So, traditional-wise, yes, and then in innovation, as Spencer said, people that shouldn't are going to anyway. We can't stop you. Mm-hmm. But it's adapting, and the only Lovers Left Alive? Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful, weird retelling of a vampire story that doesn't seem like it would make sense. And then moving even farther down the line, there was another one, What We Do in Shadows.
That was early 2010s, but yeah.
But it was also become syndicated, which is...
It didn't become syndicated, it became a TV show.
Okay, well...
Yeah, it was first a film, and then it was...
Well, Taika Waititi did a great job in taking something that was this... The gothic romance of vampires, and then being like, how you doing in the 2000s?
Yeah.
You want to be dropped in the middle of this? It took such a satirical look at vampires that it became more fun. So there's space to innovate. I'm really excited for Mahershala Ali for a new Blade. Because I don't know what to expect from it, and I wouldn't mind seeing a take for a vampire from another one.
From somebody who's not having tax evasion problems.
Perhaps, or from Guillermo del Toro.
I have to say, I hope that we move away from the classic formula. I say that with a lot of fervor because the problem is we already have staples in the classic formula. We already have like a lot of the classic films, a lot of the mainstays, from Count Orlok to the Universal Dracula film. We have a lot of opportunities within the Hammer films, whether if it's Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing, even in the blaxploitation films of, you know, like Blackula, you know, or Chris Sarandon in Fright Night. You know, there are so many different elements already that have been created within that classic formula. I feel like people are done with the classic formula. I feel like...
People want romance.
No. Well, see, there's a difference between
romance and the seduction of that.
But that doesn't mean it always has to take place in the past. That's where...
Are you talking about, was it A Vampire in Brooklyn?
No. Who's talking about that?
I don't know.
Why? That sounded like something you just pulled out of nowhere.
It
was something you just
Eddie
pulled
Murphy
out of. Okay.
In my head.
So, no, but I in all honesty, I feel like the push for perfecting the modern tale of the vampire is what's more important. You mentioned What We Do in Shadows. That is a modern setting for classic vampires. It works because you had somebody like Taika Waititi. Now, Dark Shadows was a similar storyline, but it was horrible.
No, but that's
it was a bad
the
movie,
and that's not the TV show.
No, but that's not even anywhere near What We Do in the Shadows.
Yeah.
Dark Shadows was just a one-off.
Sorry,
I don't even
Johnny
remember.
Depp.
So what I'm saying is I feel like the movie industry is going to look to create more modern, if not futuristic, settings for vampires in the near future because of the fact that where everything is going in terms of cinema... Between Universal having already the big flop with Dracula Untold, and you had other opportunities with, let's see, what else? Even in their opportunity to make the Dark Universe, mm-hmm. They're starting to see that there's not really an audience for it right now. Right now.
Right now.
Now, the history of cinema is kind of cyclical, where there's a classic period, and then it gets to more of a modern, neo-futuristic type period, and then it flops back. There's times where cinema does that, and I feel like right now we're in the vein where people want to see a more contemporary, modern-style vampire, especially like you mentioned with the new Blade coming out with Mahershala Ali. People aren't going to want to see Mahershala Ali in a Victorian, you know, outfit trying to do that and then going to the future. No, that would be a little ridiculous. And it wouldn't work for the character.
I mean, it could.
It does not work for the character.
I mean, it could.
It does not work for the character.
I don't want to see blood raves
it
anymore.
Who said that's where it's going to go?
I'm putting it out there now. I don't want to see another blood rave.
That was
it
in the last...
It gets in your eyes. It gets in your hair.
Have you been to one? Is that what you're telling me?
I was just thinking about
this woman
that.
Is going to places where they're sacrificing people and then bathing in their blood?
No, the blood rain rave.
Spencer, I told you to vet our interns. You seriously have to get on this.
I'm talking about in the beginning of blood of Blade
and yet you're
one,
talking about your experience of getting it out of your
rave.
Hair.
No, because that's all I was thinking about.
Listen, don't fall asleep. We're almost done. No, so I personally feel like I get where you guys are coming from, but I really do feel like I think the push is going to be more towards wanting a better and stronger audience to fall in love with the current day vampire, or at least the traditional vampire in a modern day setting, before they revisit that, because they have to first get Dracula down. They have to get him down first. Like, they have to get the character shaped how they want it for this current day audience. And whether you do it in the past or in the present, it doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter, because Dracula is timeless. Now, once they get that down, then they can create something that goes more towards the past or towards that time frame, something more in that element. But until then, I feel like right now it's all about the current day and age.
See, here's the thing. You're coming at this as a person who loves movies.
Yes, very. No, actually, okay,
hold on,
like,
hold on, no, hold on, hold on. No, no, no,
you
hold
have
on.
To hear him
you
out.
Literally,
this is great.
You're literally on a film podcast telling me I'm coming at it as a person who loves movies.
Yes, hold on, I'm getting there. I'm
the
getting
fact
there.
That you're on this show regularly,
yeah. But the thing is that movie studios like to make money and then also like bad ideas. Yeah, so what I feel is going to come is they're like, okay, what if it's Dracula in the past but in 8K? And like that's going to be the whole movie. And they'll put that out there. Because
no, and mind you, those are only going to solidify more and more the need to form and shape the modern day Dracula.
Right, but they're still going to try to push
because
like
if,
an old version of Dracula.
Amy, if I say Dracula from the classic years, who do you think of?
The man on your arm.
Which is?
Audio podcast. That's the word.
Audio podcast. Don't sign it. Why am I drawing
I know who it is.
Do you know who it is?
It's Bela Lugosi, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
My brain was looking and I almost said Uwe Boll. And I was like,
oh, wait, no, this is not.
I'm sorry.
Are you literally
torches for you?
All the pitchforks and torches. No, that's literally
my God.
The only reason.
She said Uwe Boll. Do you even know who what Uwe Boll looks like?
Nope.
Not like Bela Lugosi.
So
that's
Bela
worth a block alone right there.
So Bela Lugosi. The other one that I would think of is, for me personally, would be Gary Oldman's portrayal, because it's timeless, but you could have also, if you know he hadn't ended up being Dracula proper, he could have transitioned very smoothly into a contemporary story.
But that's what I'm saying. They have so much. They have well-rounded out the character so much that you could pick up that character and plop him into any time, and he would still remain Dracula.
But it would have to ride a very thin line, because there's going to be those moments of elegance and the seduction of the elegance from his initial time periods. That's what is the draw for some of his other victims. He's not going to yeet things across the room and have, like, I can honestly see a turn of where he's a social media influencer and suddenly he's coming up from nothing, or he's been a longstanding. Like, I can think up myself three or four ideas right now about how you insert Dracula into today's.
But if you don't have a well-rounded Dracula, or if you don't have somebody who has created a unique perspective that can have longevity as Dracula, it's going to fall flat. We've seen it time and time again, which is why, like, the Blade franchise has lasted in terms of its amusement so long, not because of Blade, but because of the fact that all the vampires just suck and they die
literally
easily. At one point in time in the third film, Blade Trinity, they had Triple H the wrestler as a vampire.
Really?
Yep. He was a vampire. He gets shot in the eye with a
and that was like, that I think one cool. of the problems, one of the problems for Queen of the Damned, which Spencer and I were talking, you see Aaliyah, all you're like is Aaliyah, yes, yes, goddess, yes, is that they were taking a spin on the vampires are, ooh, they're sexy rockers. Yeah, that's the seduction. And you're like, I'm not feeling you like that. Like, they were trying to make a vampire story in a place that it didn't fit.
I'm not going to lie. I listened to that soundtrack.
The soundtrack's amazing.
Dracula by Rob Zombie. And yeah, I just.
But the soundtrack. But I don't remember the guy who's the rocker, his name.
I don't remember.
Exactly. And that's part of that telling that story. And then when we transition over to Twilight with sparkly vampires, the seduction remains, but it's just, you don't want
Stuart
it.
Stuart Townsend.
Sorry, Stuart. Stuart.
And it's true because that like early 2000s vampire aesthetic was the same. The raving, you know, super electronic music type individual who just.
It was Vampire Hacker Spencer.
Yeah.
Yeah, just shaking the head. That the silence was all he needed.
So, rounding this whole thing out, obviously, we're not going to rate the film because the fact is that the film's timeless.
Literally.
It's literally lasted 100 years. Like, literally. Mm-hmm. Not metaphorically, not in some sense of a parable. The movie has been out for 100 years.
And you can watch it digitally now. Like, think about that transition from exploding film and transitioning from all of those ways to restoration now that it is digital. Like, yeah. That's bonkers.
It'd be like magic to them.
It is magic, Spencer.
I can't believe she said Bela Lugosi was Uwe Boll.
You literally put me on the spot, and I looked at your arm, and I was like, I know this man's name. And three things went in my head. Uwe Boll, Abbott and Costello. And then I was like, Luigi? No, that's wrong.
Luigi? Luigi Vampire.
Because I was trying to go Bela Lugosi, and I was getting Lugosi and Luigi. It happened.
I don't know where this episode is going right about now.
Down the pipes. It's going back to the crypt.
Back to the crypt, okay.
Yeah, that's why I keep the dead people. That's me, pretty much. I'm dead.
Here's the question I want to ask, because the roundtable question for this conversation, and I think we'll end on this, is, I don't know if you guys know, Robert Eggers, the director who did The Witch, he also did The Lighthouse, he did one other film that A24 director. There was talks of him actually directing a remake of Nosferatu with, I believe, what's his name, the one from... The one who played Ares in the movie, in The Eternals.
Oh. Wait, played Ares?
Yeah. At the end. Harry Styles.
Oh. He was going to... Sorry, my brain went to Icarus, and I was like...
I believe...
Same. I went...
No, Harry Styles, and Anya Taylor-Joy, they were going to play Hutter and Ellen. There's been talks. I don't know if there's been anything getting off the ground. But what I want to know is, so far, all we had was a Helen and a Hutter. Who would you cast in a modern-day telling of Nosferatu? Oh. There's a lot of people to choose from. There's a lot.
Yes.
Do you guys need a moment to think?
Yeah, because now that you brought that up, I forgot that AMC did a...
Nosferatu.
Yeah, which was based off Joe Hill's book, which was a new telling of Nosferatu. That has the seduction power, but it'd still be super creepy.
Mm-hmm. Here's a gimme. I'll give you guys a gimme.
Not Willem Dafoe.
Well, hold on. Here's the gimme. It can be somebody who maybe has played it before, but is still capable of playing it now. So that throws Gary Oldman out.
I mean, that would, to be very honest, anybody who has worked with Gary Oldman could probably go back and have a conversation with him. Not Keanu Reeves. I'm sorry, buddy. But could get that insight that was necessary to play the same type of allure that he has in that movie. Mm-hmm. But I hear you. I know small children would be like, Willem Dafoe. And I'm like, no.
Everybody's Willem Dafoe crazy right now.
Yep.
So.
Oh, this is hard. Spencer, do you have any ideas?
So.
Don't say Drake Bell.
I'm not. I don't even know where that came
where
from.
Where did that come from?
He's already in trouble with stuff. Go ahead.
Anyway, I don't know who I get for, like, Count Orloff, because that's a really hard role to fill. You need someone who's, like, right, like, a whole mess of things. And I can't think of, like, the only person I can think of I would not want in that role, and that's Nicolas Cage.
I'm sorry. Did I mention he's actually in the process of filming a vampire movie as we speak?
Of course he is.
It's him.
Yeah.
We're kind of, is he stealing the Declaration of Independence again as a vampire?
No, but he's got a really ridiculous outfit that he's wearing. I'm looking up the picture. Go ahead, keep going.
Gosh, oh, yes. But, like, I would like to see more justice for Ellen, because... Oh, no.
He just saw the picture. Like, justice for Ellen. Oh, no.
I would turn it around so you can see, but I'll show you after the fact. It's bad.
It's... Oof. Magoof right there.
Oof, Magoof.
Wow. Yeah, so here's the thing. Like, I want to see, like, a stronger female lead for her, especially for how she ends the movie as, like, basically saving the town.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the whole movie, she was, like, fainting or whatever, and I'm like, I don't know what her character arc is.
Yeah.
So I'd like, like a Michelle Rodriguez type person come in and, like, be like, I'm awesome.
Michelle Rodriguez.
Yeah.
That woman hasn't been anything since SWAT.
She coming for you.
Here's the thing. If we're talking about a Count Orlok, we're looking at somebody who wouldn't look too disturbing with a bulbous head.
Who's that?
Nobody.
But that doesn't mean that he can't be youngish. So my thought is, I wouldn't mind seeing Henry Cavill.
He would have to slim down quite a bit.
So it's between Henry Cavill or Timothée Chalamet.
So speaking of that, because... So, I was on the... This is going to sound weird. So, Alexander Skarsgård,
mm-hmm.
He played...
Pennywise.
That's Bill.
Oh, Bill. Although Bill Skarsgård, too.
No. So, Alexander Skarsgård played a vampire in True Blood. He had the tall, lanky, moody thing down... And he had a gaunt look to his face, which you could do for that, which would work. I had Timothée Chalamet on my list, and then I had, oh my gosh.
Ah, it is him.
Yeah.
No, he's, yeah, go ahead.
And then,
was the bad Tarzan Spencer.
Yeah, he was the terrible Tarzan. I am not going to put Adam Driver in that list.
Although that wouldn't be bad.
If we got, he could go bald and be kind of scary, but he'd still, again, a lot of these people to get the gaunt look to their face is what you're kind of aiming at. So yeah, I mean, it's hard.
Oh, you know who else?
Richard Armitage?
What?
I don't know. It just came up on my list. Like, I'm literally just looking at people, and I'm like, they're tall, that. Slender people.
By the way, I've always had a chip on my shoulder for Alexander Skarsgård, because the first thing I saw him in was Straw Dogs. And in Straw Dogs, it's literally a scene of, like, a rape, and he's kind of leading it. So it's, yeah.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, Straw Dogs is a really hard movie. You know, I was thinking about Spencer. Daniel Radcliffe. He did do that movie, Horns.
And he did, yeah. And that was pretty good.
He does play a pretty diabolical, charming-esque, in the beginning, individual in The Lost City. So,
I mean, it's the just, movie that just came out.
Yeah.
Well, one thing's for sure, it can't be Eddie Redmayne.
Eddie Redmayne's just too soft-spoken. I don't think he can create that kind of...
The one thing that I've seen him in where he's super creepy and ethereal was going to be Jupiter Ascending, and but, he was just creepy. And he's wonderful. Yeah. He's a delight.
Oh, that movie got so many Razzies, it's not even funny.
it's closing on Catwoman territory.
Do you think that they could have a Count Orlok character in a future film without him having a bulbous head?
Yeah.
Would that still have the same effect?
No. Well, that... Because
it depends on, like... That depends on, like, how... Like, foreboding this character is.
Well, let's... If we look at
Because, like, if you look at, like, somebody like Jack Nicholson, who... No, well, I'm just saying, like... I'm just saying, like, the ability of him back in the 70s when he did The Shining, like, his foreboding character was more so, like, in his facial expressions.
Well, and that's the... I keep bringing it back to Gary Oldman. They gave him a prosthetic and a wig to accentuate his head. But when he transitioned to being around more people, not just, you know, Keanu Reeves, he suddenly shifted to the seduction, to the Tom Cruise about town, Brad Pitt about town interview.
But Gary Oldman's very versatile, though.
But that's the thing, that temporarily, if Count Orlok and first meeting Hutter is creepy Count Orlok, we have prosthetics to make bulbous heads. The seduction of it comes when you finally introduce him back into society where the prey is.
Well, who knows? That's a question for the audience. And if you have any thoughts or anything, drop us a line on our social pages over at facebook.com/filmlosophers or on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101. This was a great episode. And obviously, we want you to get a chance if you haven't seen it yet. It is available on Amazon Prime as well as YouTube. You can catch it on one of those platforms. I'm pretty sure it's probably somewhere else you can buy it. But check it out. It's a great film. It's definitely a very special part of cinematic history, and it would be remiss if you missed out on the opportunity to see it. Like I said, this was a great show. And Amy, thank you for sharing with us with your Jane Unseen. Where can people find you?
The only place Jane Unseen lives, hopefully whenever she gets to putting up her thingies, on Instagram at Jane Unseen.
You're putting up your thingies?
The snippets, the bits.
You're putting up your bits on Instagram?
Bits.
They're going to...
walking into a trap.
This is a family show, madam.
Get to the chopper.
Remember, you can also check us out on our website at filmlosophers.com. There we got everything from romance to anime to action. Everything that you're looking for, we got over 300 episodes of it. We got it. Check us out over at our website, filmlosophers.com. Also, you can find us on any podcast streaming app, whether if it's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn. You can tune in on each one of those platforms and find us there. Give us a subscribe, give us a follow, give us a 5-star review. Give us your money. I'm just kidding. But yeah, check us out there. Amy's giving me a weird look.
I didn't. I'm looking at other things. Like this.
Like that. Whatever that is. Because this is a visual podcast.
Yes.
Again, you should check out the film. 100 years. I mean, man, I'm excited to see what movie is going to be so influential in the next 100 years that the next generation is going to get a chance to see that. Mm-hmm. So this
Lord
is
of the Rings.
Oh, more than likely, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, or, you know, the Amazing Bulk. Who knows?
Definite contender.
There we go.
But that about wraps up another awesome show of the Filmlosophers. Thank you for listening. And from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
I'm intern Amy.
That's right, you are. Class dismissed.
Sparkly vengeance.